A 2004 study by the Centers for Disease Control found that 10% of American women and 4% of men were taking antidepressants. 33 million Americans that year were prescribed at least one psychiatric drug. Our guest, Charles Barber, believes that's far too many. Barber says while medications are essential in treating serious psychiatric illnesses, including clinical depression, aggressive marketing by drug companies has resulted in too many prescriptions for people with symptoms of mild depression. Barber says research shows drugs are far less effective than advertised for mild depression, and new talk therapies show better and more long-lasting results. Barber isn't a psychiatrist, but he spent years working with the mentally ill homeless, and he's now a lecturer in psychiatry at the Yale School of Medicine. In an earlier book, Songs from the Black Chair, Barber described his own battle with obsessive and compulsive disorder. His new book is Comfortably Numb: How Psychiatry is Medicating a Nation. Well, Charles Barber, in this book, you give us a little thumbnail history of psychiatry, how it's gone from folks who cared for severely mentally ill people in asylums to periods when Freudian psychoanalysis was in vogue. But you say what we now see is the triumph of biological psychiatry. What do you mean?
And biological and corporate psychiatry, just going back to the roots, psychiatry was conducted for many years in the asylums. And they were often horrific and ill-advised treatments, although many of them were well-intentioned. And I think it's sort of interesting to note that a lot of the asylums of the 19th century were established on beautiful, serene, valuable pieces of land where people thought that nature would help people recover. So a lot of it was well-intentioned, but a lot of the methods were horrendous, lobotomies and so on. Psychiatry then moved into the community really when on the strength of Freudian psychoanalysis, and particularly after World War I and World War II, where a lot of European analysts came to the United States and started conducting office practice. And sort of the prestige of the field in particularly the 50s and 60s went into sort of starting to treat the worried well in office-based practices. Psychiatry now, really Prozac is the one drug that made it happen this way, is really a sort of a corporate phenomenon based on the biological understanding of mental illness. And so, you know, it's permeated the pop culture on the strength of the biological understanding of psychiatry and the sense of the technology that the corporate world of these big drug industries has embraced.
And you're arguing that what we're seeing is a lot of over-prescription of medications, which might be very effective for serious conditions, not so effective for less serious conditions.
Yeah, my book is largely a critique of cosmetic psychopharmacology. You shouldn't take drugs, I argue, unless you have a medical condition or a serious condition. There are times, I grant you, that the drugs seem to be effective for these milder conditions, but there should be other things looked at first, or certainly in the context of medication, that we've completely overlooked in this sort of, you know, the huge marketing and the huge hype around this very high-tech solution. Not to say, and I never argue in the book, that the drugs can't be terribly effective for severe and persistent mental illness. I've worked with people who have killed themselves because of depression. I've worked with people, you know, who wouldn't speak to me when they're depressed, and when they were well, we had a wonderful relationship. People with terribly disabling conditions, I saw over and over again the life-saving implications of antipsychotics or lithium for bipolar disorder, for example. What I argue for in the book is the farther you get away from severe and persistent mental illness, which is a obvious biological condition, and you start prescribing these serious agents, these powerful agents for mild, very mild conditions, or even no conditions at all, for really what are life problems, for divorces, for the stress of divorce, then the risk-benefit ratio of the drugs becomes far more dubious.
Okay, fair enough. But are you saying that someone who feels is feeling unhappy and thinks that they might benefit from improving their relationship with their spouse, or thinking about their life or career choices differently, or exploring maybe the ways that their family background has sort of given them some debilitating emotional habits. Are you saying that they should not seek help, or that they should simply not so quickly run to a chemical antidepressant?
They absolutely should seek help. I'm a great believer in treatment, in psychiatric treatment, in all of its forms. What I think makes a lot of sense is the British guidelines for mild to moderate depression, and they suggested very simple things for again, I'm talking about mild depression: exercise, diet, counseling, particularly cognitive behavioral therapy, very focused, structured type of therapy. And then if those things don't work, then going to the antidepressants. I think that that's a wise way of looking at it.
And in America, we find that a lot of the antidepressants are actually dispensed by family physicians, right, who
absolutely
see it as a quick way to help somebody get better.
Right. That's something that's really changed, again, with Prozac sort of being the main drug that changed the whole landscape. It used to be that psychiatric drugs were prescribed by psychiatrists. And now the majority of antidepressants, for example, are prescribed by family doctors, PCPs. And so I think doctors who are very under pressure in the managed care environment have these patients coming in. They're harried. They got to see people quickly. And people are asking for drugs, and they seem to know a little something about them. And I think doctors have felt under tremendous pressure to prescribe, even when they feel ambivalent about it.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Charles Barber. He is a lecturer in psychiatry at the Yale Medical School. He has a new book about the overprescription of antidepressants in America. It's called Comfortably Numb: How Psychiatry is Medicating a Nation. Well, the second half of your book is really about alternatives to antidepressants and other medications that are being prescribed so widely. And I thought we would just focus on one, cognitive behavioral therapy, which you suggest has developed techniques that are so successful that if it could be bottled and marketed like Prozac, we would know all about it. In a nutshell, just describe the technique if you can briefly. What makes it so effective?
When I talk about cognitive behavioral therapy, which is called CBT, I'm not talking about it as a panacea. And I think part of our maturing and our understanding of these illnesses and severe psychiatric illnesses are chronic and disabling is understanding that nothing takes them away magically. However, having said that, CBT is the most validated psychotherapy treatment in history. There have been something like 400 outcome studies for depression and increasingly a broad range of conditions, PTSD, panic disorder, and so on. And CBT is a focused, short, very targeted, practical therapy, usually 12 sessions, that sets very specific goals, and it targets the thoughts, beliefs, and attitudes that lie behind particular behaviors. So, for example, there will be homework assignments given on a particular situation that makes one depressed or anxious, and the patient, with the collaboration of the therapist, and it's a very – unlike, psychoanalysis where everything is sort of hidden and murky, this is very open, set the goals right up front, very practical, and the patient will come back with the homework and say, when my boss talked to me like this, it brought up all these feelings that I was worthless. And those sort of feelings, by the way, are associated with depression. And I think that that's based on, my core belief that I'm worthless. And let's look, and then the therapist and the patient will look together at ways of skills to maybe avoid those situations or do things differently in those situations, which lead to concrete changes and a sort of a toolkit to avoid the situations or master the situations that get someone into trouble. And the outcomes for CBT for milder depression, not for major depression, but for milder depression, are extremely strong, have been shown to be equal, at times stronger than the drugs. But the critical factor, though, is the relapse rates. The relapse rates, in other words, getting depressed again, and that's a big risk with depression because it's a chronic illness, are significantly lower for people that have underwent CBT. They know what to do in certain situations. They know how to mitigate against those things, and they have the confidence and the awareness, and they feel like they're in charge.
Our guest is Charles Barber. His new book is Comfortably Numb. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is Charles Barber. He is a lecturer in psychiatry at the Yale Medical School. His new book is Comfortably Numb, How Psychiatry is Medicating a Nation. Well, you know, Charles Barber, as I was preparing for the interview, I thought I discovered you'd written an earlier book, a memoir called Songs from the Black Chair, and decided I would take a quick look at it. And mm-hmm. I picked it up and found I just couldn't put it down. It is a truly absorbing and beautifully written story, which begins with your kind of just revisiting the suicide of a boyhood friend. Mm-hmm. But in this, we learn that you yourself suffer from a mental illness, obsessive compulsive disorder. I wonder if you could describe a moment when the symptoms of this illness really overtook you. Tell us how you experienced it, what it was like.
I experienced it, you know, from age 5 or 6, kind of disturbing thoughts or thoughts that I needed to do something. That I didn't want to do, you know, silly things like, you know, you got to wear this red shirt to school tomorrow or you'll die when you're age 18. And, you know, I had little thoughts like that throughout, you know, elementary school and stuff. It really, it's fully manifested itself late teens, freshman year in college, which is when, by the way, most mental illnesses, probably having to do with the maturation of the brain, manifest themselves. And so I became very, you know, overwhelmed, particularly my freshman year in college, with repeating very classic OCD symptoms. I had no idea what I was experiencing at the time, by the way, but repeating words, repeated thoughts that I couldn't get out of my mind, certain compulsions. And then in my case, very crippling ideas that I had hurt other people. You know, driving, feeling that you hit someone when you were out driving and you can't quite, you know, you got to go check the car that you didn't hit them, that there wasn't a gash on the car and things like that. So I was very disabled for a period in my life during college in particular.
You know, when I read your new book, Comfortably Numb, which is really about treatment practices and mental health policy issues, it is written with a very strong sense of conviction. And I wondered, after I read the second book and saw your own experience, that it seemed to me maybe that your opinions were informed in a different way. I mean, not just, you know, clinical trials and anecdotes, but your mm-hmm. own palpable connection to mental illness.
Yeah. You know, first I said, you know, my issues are extremely well controlled these days. But I think that I underwent a recovery process and social choices that I made were essential to that recovery process. So I dropped out of Harvard at the sort of the worst of some of this stuff, and I decided to work at a group home for people with developmental disabilities. Formerly, the term was mentally retarded, and I did that for 2 or 3 years. It was extremely unpopular with my family and so on, but that was really the beginning in many ways of my recovery and sort of a path that I suppose has led to the writing of these books and my career.
You know, it is interesting that, I mean, you described how, you know, your work with the mentally ill homeless was an important and meaningful thing. And yet, you know, you also got treatments. You had some cognitive behavioral therapy, mm-hmm. which you said was helpful. And you took Prozac, which is ironic given that so much of the new book deals with the overuse of Prozac. Was Prozac helpful to you?
It was helpful, particularly initially, and I think part of that might have been the I actually took it right when it came out, and my expectations for the drugs, and perhaps a placebo effect of my own, but it was very effective. Again, I feel this is sort of informs the writing of this book, where for a time in my life, I really did suffer from serious psychiatric stuff. However, the things that stuck, the things that really made me want to get better in the first place, had to do with the social context. In my case, I found a connection with people with disabilities. I found I was very good at the work. And it was a way that I found meaning. And so to the degree that I had symptoms in the future, I was able to say there's sort of a reason and a structure for this. I think the other critical component is that I was the activist. I decided, and it was very unpopular, you know, to drop out of Harvard and work it for $5 an hour. But it was my choice. And what you find, again, in talking to people that get better, that they do better when they feel in control and they are managing their treatment, even if it includes medical and medicinal treatment. And the new paradigm for psychiatric treatment that I argue for in the book is more of a collaboration between a doctor or a therapist and the patient. Traditional psychiatry, it's extremely hierarchical.
Do you still take Prozac?
Yes, I do.
Uh-huh. So you still find it helpful?
I do, yeah. But again, the things that that make me happy are my writing, my role as a father, my role as a husband, my vocation as a writer. And so I've right. Those are the things that matter to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, the symptoms that you described your first year at Harvard seemed very serious as I read them. I mean, you would yeah. be up all night, and these phrases would repeat through your mind. You would black. I mean, truly debilitating. Can you recall what it was like to be there? Can you connect to what that felt like?
It seems like another person, you know. It was harrowing. It was absolutely harrowing. And again, that's why I think I can make the distinction between serious conditions
right.
that are truly horrific, and you can't, unless you've experienced them, you don't really know, versus, you know, it's February, I'm depressed. So I think that, you know, the second book, Comfortably Numb, is informed by that sort of understanding that I think I can contend that I have of what's the difference between severe and not a medical condition.
Well, Charles Barber, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Charles Barber is a lecturer in psychiatry at the Yale Medical School. He recounts his battle with obsessive and compulsive disorder in Songs from the Black Chair. His new book is Comfortably Numb: How Psychiatry is Medicating a Nation.